Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and carefully pull out the stitches in its seams to see what the stuffing inside is made of. Or at least we normally do, unless we get wildly off course and end up talking about the psychological experience of playing role-playing games at all. But I'm getting ahead of myself. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host today is Emma Acosta. If you will indulge a quick diversion. As you may have surmised from the past few episodes of this show, I like games that have been polished to an absolutely perfect sheen. Real oyster pearl shit. This is why most of my games are like 4 pages long. It's such hard work to polish anything that's bigger than that. Anything longer just so rarely gets to the same level of elegance. And Em's work gets there. She puts in the long hours and has the talent, and it shows in her work. Right now, that's primarily her whimsical duology of fairy tale games, Crescent Moon, a game where you play tweens lost in a strange wonderland, and The Exiles, the same game but now you're late teens and the wonderland is hell itself, and you're fighting your way out because you're angsty. I was also lucky enough to get to work with her on the first issue of her Hedge Maze Mail, a Patreon where she sends you some cool shit every month, including a letter-sized game by some cool and often extremely handsome guest author. And as if I wasn't already gushing too much, Em went and brought in a beautiful mechanic from The Watch, a game designed by one of my best friends and future co-host, Ash Kreider. But in the meantime, you can listen to Em and I talk about The Watch and its PBTA move, Change the World, a mandatory glimmer of hope in what is otherwise a horrifying game about the cost of war and the terrors of patriarchy. This episode is the most wild and free-ranging conversation I've had yet on this show. Em and I start with The Watch and with Changing the World, sure, but we end up talking about how more rigid game structures can actually create bigger emotions in players, and how rules and play culture are constantly influencing each other, and how we love crying at the table, and little guys, TM, and I don't know, I just adored this episode. A++, no notes, I'm gonna shut up now, let's get to it. Here is Emma Acosta with Change the World. Em, thanks so much for being here. So
thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what mechanic have you brought for us today?
I have brought the move Change the World from The Watch.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about The Watch.
So The Watch is this military fantasy RPG where you play as a group of women that have banded together to defeat the Shadow, which is this corrupt force that has torn the hearts of men into merciless soldiers. So like the entire clan lands, because the world is like divided into clans, has been overtaken by this force. And now the men are doing really nasty things, as they sometimes do in the real world as well. And women have decided that they need to fight back against that and eradicate the Shadow, in part because they don't want to die, but also because they want like their loved ones back.
Yeah, my favorite line in the text of this book is a heading that's like, psst, the Shadow is the patriarchy. That like this game is not subtle about what it's doing.
Yeah. Right?
Like you're going to literal war with the patriarchy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like why I like this game, which I really, really like, I played a very long campaign of it, like over 20 sessions. And firstly, as you might have guessed from the premise, it's really sad. It's a bit of a heart-wrenching experience. And what's interesting about it is that contrary to what you might expect, you spend most of the game on camp. I don't know if this will hold true for you, Sam. I know you've also played The Watch a bunch. But on our campaign, it was roughly like 70% camp scenes and just like about a third of the game just devoted to
That was about right for us.
Like
the
missions.
Whole point. Yeah. The point of the game, it's sort of based on Night Witches originally,
yeah,
I think.
Which I haven't played, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, I've played like a one-shot, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Like the structure of the game is designed so that, yeah, you have to go out and like go to war and like do battle, but like we don't really care about that part. We like care about the fact that your best friend died and now we want to go have a bunch of scenes where you're really fucked up about it. Like that's what the game is about. It's about the consequences of war, not the like going out there and doing the war. And in that way, it's also true that there's never a chance that you're going to lose. Like The game is not interested in a story that is so sad that you lose to the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. Like, you always defeat the patriarchy, and the game is about what does it cost you?
Yeah, like, who are you after that? Yeah. Who are your comrades after that? It's kind of like, and I've heard this term used for Exiles, which, like, is very, very influenced by The Watch, but I think it holds up perfectly as well for this game, which is, it's like a misery simulator. In the sense that you go on these missions and you do terrible things happen to you. But that's only like 20 minutes of the session, and then you spend the rest of the session crying about it. And then you repeat that over every session.
Yeah. Yeah. The game is about the crying about it. Like, exactly. That's the whole point.
Yeah. It's not really about like the actual actions. Although you get to explore their consequences. But for sure. I also find interesting that like, the game, although you, as you have already pointed out, you are going to win, it can also, like, that doesn't mean that the battle feels, like, upbeat or easy. I think, like, especially if you are playing, like, a long campaign, like, it really wears down on you, like, the whole thing. Like, it feels really brutal. And on our campaign, at least, we really got into, you get some leeway about what exactly you want the shadow to represent within the context of patriarchal forces. But on our campaign, we really honed in on the theme that the fight is endless because the shadow can never be truly killed as it lives within all of us, right? So there was always that sense that although we are doing this work, and we kind of had this explored even in the epilogues, that like it can rise up again anytime, right? So like, why are we fighting now? And you know, it gets rough to deal with that every week.
Yeah, and I think like we had several protagonist characters. There was one player at the table who was just like, I'm gonna get as many of my PCs fucked up and killed in horrible ways as I possibly can, and just like meat grindered through them at a certain point.
Wow.
But like every single PC had just horrible things happen to them. Like yes, you win on a like societal level, but like every single person who was in the trenches dies or comes out with horrific PTSD or worse. Like, it's real. There's plenty to cry about on the personal level.
Yeah, for sure. Also, I would like to quickly touch on the murky gender dynamics as well, because and to be fair, although I adore this game, I haven't like actually sat down and read through the text. I was a player rather than a GM in that campaign, so I'm not sure exactly where it stands. But when we say women, like, really, the way we read that, at the very least, was anything but a cis man. So there was also, like, a lot of space for non-binary characters or trans characters.
Yeah, and that's very much the intent. I mean, the game was published in 2017, which feels like a generation ago at this point in terms of conversations about gender. And I know, like, I to journalistically disclose, like, the game that I played was GM'd by the designer of this game, right? And they, I know, have a lot of updates that they are interested in making to the game's gender dynamics in particular. But yeah, that stuff is there if you're reading the text.
Yeah, for sure.
So normally we get into the mechanic right away, but I felt like this one wanted a little bit more kind of background on the game before we dived in. So without further ado, tell us about the actual mechanic, Change the World.
Change the World. When you assail the Shadow's lands, and again when you defeat the Shadow, your efforts have the chance to change the world. Roll with the number of jaded moves you've taken.
So to be clear, this is powered by the Apocalypse game, so when you're rolling plus the number of jaded moves, that's 2d6 plus your stat, and you're kind of doing the like 10 plus is good, 7 to 9 is okay, 6 or less you fucked it up. And then jaded specifically is this kind of parallel XP track that exists in the game that fills up when you do things that wear you down and kind of snowballs on itself. It's similar to Ruin in Apocalypse Keys, where if you kind of take it too far, you get too much of it, you get these cool special abilities because you've like learned to be jaded. You can use that a little bit, but then eventually you like retire or die or trauma out because you just got too sad. And that's just... So back to the move.
On a 10 plus, tell the MC, which is the GM by the way, something positive that has changed within society through the efforts of the Watch. On a 7 to 9, the change only occurs within your own clan. On a miss, while assailing the Shadowlands, the change only occurs within your own clan, but it enrages the Shadow and it does everything it can to strike back at your people. On a miss, after defeating the Shadow, the change occurs in your clan alone, but only as a result of deep cultural trauma inflicted by the Shadow's occupation. Just a fun little move.
Yeah.
It's just...
I mean, you could... I feel like I spent like a minute talking about how like the game is interested in what it costs you to do war, and then like the move itself has in there a much more elegant way of putting it. But yeah, here we are. Great. So yeah, what do you love about this? What made you really want to bring this in particular?
So the thing that stuck out to me about this move the first time I saw it is how a piece of the design that is so sparingly used, because if you're playing a short campaign, you might not ever see this because it only comes up on the third phase of the game. So it comes up when you are beginning the final act and you trigger it again when you finish the final act. So a lot of people will never even play this. And then if you're playing a long campaign, you only get to trigger it twice. However, it's such potential to like have an everlasting impact on the story, because after so many sessions where you are just describing these terrible things and getting really, really sad about them, you finally get the chance to have, both as players and as characters, to be reminded of why you are doing this in the first place, right? Like you want to have a better world. And this move allows you to say all the sacrifice that you've made in some way will have impacted the world in a positive fashion, even if the Shadow still wants to kill you, even if it retaliates. Like in none of these options is like you don't do it. It's just the Shadow gets really mad about it, but like you still do the thing.
Yeah, that sort of relief after session after session of terror and tears is really profound, I think.
For sure.
It's a nice moment. I think that there's something really interesting in all of that about how, as a designer, if you want a particular story beat to happen in the game, you can just kind of tell the players that it happens now. Just like make a mechanic where it happens now and force them to do it. I think there are a lot of games that sort of like dance around things or are trying to like construct a like set of tools that are going to push people in a particular direction.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of power in just saying, no, now is the time when this is the thing that happens now. And like several years ago, I would have felt like, that's going to feel really heavy-handed. Like, I don't know, is that really going to be effective? Mm-hmm. But every time I've run into a mechanic like this that just says, do the thing now, it plays incredibly well. It's so good. It's so nice as a player to be given the story beat and then just to take the story beat and you really make it your own. There's so much detail you got to fill in at this point about like your campaign and your people's details and like your mother back home, like who's still in the clan and how she's affected by all this. Like there's so much room still to explore that becomes so much easier to explore when you have this like really tight, okay, like here's the thing that happens like very, very precisely on a structural level.
And I think that's the strength of PBTA, really, like just the doing the thing, right? Like just really explicitly calling out, here's when you do this bit. I also feel like you're personally calling me out because I am very much of the kind of designer that we like create like all this magical framework for you to come into your own conclusions and like realize things. And I think elements of surprise are funny or fun rather, but on the other hand, just like a really obvious like point where like something happens And especially as players, you might not know this is coming. Like, as players, yeah, we had no idea this was coming. So it was just like, oh, wow. Like, we're getting to do a nice thing for once.
Yeah.
I also think it's like such a good testament of how games have this power to induce really emotional moments through really technical language, which is something that I just find beautiful about games in general. Like, you read these and it's just a bunch of instructions, right? But then when you get to apply them onto the story and onto the baggage that you have created, it can like result on like really powerful bleeding moments as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Big catharsis from friggin' math, right?
Like, yeah. Which is also like a testament to game text doesn't need to be prose heavy to be impactful. I think if there was a version of this move that was like all poetic and flowery on like describing this, I don't think it would be particularly more effective than what this is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I, as someone who makes a lot of art about emotional repression, especially, like, that's, I really identify with that. Where I think there's, I can think of, like, Wander Home has a much more sort of poetic sense to it. It has a lot less technical language, in part because there's, like, no math in the game, right?
Yeah.
That poetry kind of layer brings a certain mood and like style and flavor to the game, where I think you're right that this move in The Watch like is very technical, which in some ways like leaves more of an open canvas for you to bring your emotional thing to
exactly.
it, whatever that is.
Yes.
Going back to that idea of you can just tell people what the story beat is and go forward, like, I think you can actually get a lot more specific even than this pretty specific move gets. Like, a lot of Firebrand's games, especially, you know, the designer of this went on to make Our Traveling Home a few years ago, which is just like basically a screenplay for Howl's Moving Castle, like as a technical manual, where just every scene is just laid out in two pages and you like follow along like a full two pages of instructions for like how you go moment by moment. It gets down to like, you're doing chores now, here are your five options for chores, pick one to do and describe how you do it. Like, that's how precise it gets. And there's still room for you to be like, well, I'm a scarecrow, so I'm made of broomsticks, so like I'm sweeping and it looks like that, and you can still build all this filigree and like magic up around it. And this works the same way, I think, where you can fill in. I'm just saying the same thing I did before, but you have all this room to fill in details in a way that's really magical.
Actually, let me become the host for a second. How did that go for you? Like, how does a game that's just made out of these types of moves feels in the sense of providing you still enough liberty to feel like you are putting your own spirit into it?
Yeah, when I started playing it, I was like, interesting. I don't know. Okay, let's see how this goes.
Sure.
Yeah, but I found it to just work incredibly well. That really what I think we're looking for in any kind of story game anyway is basically emotional catharsis. And honestly, like, the tighter you fit to a like movie that's already providing that, like, probably the closer you're gonna get. Like, good movies are already good at that. If you just tell people like, walk through this movie but like riff on it with your friends, like, you probably get to that emotional catharsis pretty well. So yeah, so for me, like, that game and, you know, a game like Stew Pot is another sort of game that has a pretty rigid structure to it, like, gives me really a lot of pleasure and a lot of, and still a lot of difference every time I play it.
Yeah. I'm also thinking back on Wander Home and how Wander Home doesn't necessarily have a structure. You create, as far as I remember, you create the location and then you explore the location until you decide that it's time to go on. However, it does have an implicit structure in the token economy and in the way that your character's moves, like, interact with one another. So it sounds like you could either go for the macro, which is these are the scenes that this game is going to provide you with, and you're just cycling through those scenes collectively. Mm-hmm. Or you can take that same approach, but apply it to each individual archetype. So as the dancer, yeah, I have these couple of beats that I'm always going to be doing, or I'm going to be like switching between in, like, let's say a 3-session cycle, and then I get more things, and I can like keep adding quirks to that core, and yeah, that's still providing you a structure. It just doesn't feel like there's a structure, because every person is in their own little wheel, essentially.
Well, and that brings us back to PBTA games kind of at large too, are essentially that, like, every move is like, here's the little beat in a scene and how mm-hmm. it's going to work. Like, here's how fighting works in this genre, or here's how you can be weird and just appear in this scene because you're a weirdo. Like, that's a genre thing about your character. And whatever moves you have are, as you're saying, like in Wander Home, which it's, I mean, technically PBTA, I think.
Technically, very, like, technically.
Very technically. But it is, you have that same sort of collection, as you're saying, of like, here are the beats I could bring to any given scene. And it's mixing and matching those beats that gives you your particular story.
Yeah. I'm also thinking if there's, like, if every move in the watch is in this style, or if there's, like, pockets of space where you have more freedom, and then this is a contrast to that. Because the watch is also, like, really formulaic in its mission structure as well.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to say, is that the mission structure feels a lot like this. Like, there's
for
4
sure.
moves, and you assign one of them to each person, and you go through them in order every time, and like the mission structure is very rigid to like get that emotional meat you can go
and
cry
surprisingly,
about.
Surprisingly, it doesn't get old. I don't know what Ash did, but it doesn't get old, even though you're literally doing the same thing over and over and over and over every session.
Yeah, I mean, like, Blaze in the Dark doesn't get old for me either, right? Like, like, you know, it's not as rigid in the same way, but I think that there's a lot of room for different kinds of missions, a different flavor you can fill into the given structure, even if the like overall idea of like, we're going to go fight the shadow, or like, we're going to go on a heist now, or like mm-hmm. whatever. It's like a procedural TV show, right? Like Columbo every week just solves a friggin' another murder mystery, but it's great every time, even though it's got that same kind of structure to it. And watch missions, I think, are pretty similar.
Yeah.
But then the downtime is then kind of the other version of this that we were talking about, where you have a bunch of different moves, like mm-hmm. your playbook. You've got jaded moves, which are a certain set of beats that tend to be a little bit more jaded. You've got a bunch of like regular playbook moves, which again are a certain set of beats. And then the basic moves that everyone can do, just like any standard PBTA game.
I would say it is precisely during the camp where you get that sort of like open, like, recess is what I would describe it as, where like you still have the moves, but like not every move will get triggered every camp in the same order, so it can like open up to player expression a bit more easily. I would also say that with the missions, it might sound like they are very constraining, but what I found was that those constraints, I was also like, the GM I had when I was playing this was mental, and they would not allow for any like divergence from this structure, which I think really works to the strength of this game. Because if I was running this game, I am too chaotic to like say that we're gonna do an entire mission and an entire camp phase like every session. I would maybe try that once, and then like the rest of the campaign would go off the rails. But with this GM, he was like, no, we're going to do the exact same formula every single time. And there are going to be absolutely zero exceptions. And what I found over time with the mission structure is that that really forced us to create these very interesting situations where, because the missions had to be short, because we needed time for camp, so the mission couldn't be longer than 30 minutes, really. And there were already like these four roles that we feel and we body. Then it became about how can we make, like, what are the hooks or like the beats or like the specifics of this setup that make this different from all of the rest? And the book does provide some guidance in like, you have like a list of scene of like mission ideas, but that really created an environment where like, I can think still of several missions and like what made all of those special. And that was all us, because the game didn't really like give any leeway to create that mechanically.
The other thing that that lets you do is jump over all the parts in every mission that are going to feel pretty similar. Like, you know, I was playing a version of this game set on Mars where you're kind of fighting aliens. And, you know, who cares about just like mowing down another crowd of aliens? It was like, yeah, cool. We get the action sequence where we like mow down some more aliens. And then someone's been stabbed through the heart. And like, that's the part that we can like dwell on for this particular mission. It's the part that sort of breaks the structure, becomes the interesting part that you actually give screen time to.
Yeah.
Hey campers, have you heard of season 5 of 5 GMs in a Trenchcoat from Inside the Tent? You haven't? Well, let us tell you about it.
A nice, green, natural regional park. This is Hidden Falls Regional Park. For our purposes in our world, it's a bit larger than it actually is. It is the summer of 1983, and it is all of your first time getting to stay at Hidden Falls.
We promise it's going to be a great time. It's going to be a story of three childhood friends going across the Americas in 1987 using Kids on Bikes 2nd edition. So grab a blanket, make some coffee. The first three episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a phrase I have come up with that I'm very proud of that I don't want to get through this discussion without saying, which is rail shooter RPG, where I feel like, you know, the kind of really structured story beat that we're talking about can feel like you're being railroaded to some extent. Like with Change the World, like it's very specific, as we have said, about what the next beat is. It can feel like you are being forced into that track, and you are. But you know, as I was playing Our Traveling Home, especially, which is entirely that, it felt like playing a rail shooter, like one of these games where you're on a track being guided to the next place where you're going to shoot some more aliens or whatever. But that doesn't make it not fun. Like, it's totally fine. Mm-hmm. I feel totally fine and excited to be on the ride of whatever story the game is setting up for me, as long as I have that interactivity of being able to stop and like point this direction and fill in this thing and like kind of like, you know, kibitz with my friends along the way. I think there's just a lot of fun to be had with that kind of storytelling or game playing rather.
Yeah. And I think like that clashes with some, especially in more traditional circles, right?
Yeah.
Where it's all about like player freedom is really valued. And I think there's still a lot of freedom to be had in these games. It's just structured differently. Like, the indents that are there for you to feel are different than the ones that would conventionally be thought from an RPG, which could be more of like, the world is yours and you can do whatever you want. You cannot do that in The Watch. You cannot just like run into the woods and say, actually, I don't want to go to war anymore. Like, you are not doing that,
you
right?
can.
Like,
your character can run and do that, and maybe and does when make they max out their jaded, but like, we're not going to follow that story. Like, exactly. Goodbye. Now we're going to come
and
back.
And I remember the first time I played The Watch, it was one of the first, like, PBTA games that I really got into. And that was difficult for me at first, because it was like, well, but what do you mean that we have to like follow this structure? It definitely took some adjustment to adapt to that style of gaming where you are not so much thinking in terms of what can I do? And it's more about how can I flourish this narrative in a way that's thematically resonant with the people that I'm playing with.
It's almost like the sort of freedom you have as a player is just happening at a different scale. Mm-hmm. It's like you, instead of operating on that global, like Dungeons and Dragons fantasy, I can wander around anywhere on this disc that the world is, you know, instead it's, okay, you can play however you want, just like play in this particular sandbox, you know, play in the sandbox of the watch back at the base. You can go talk to anyone on your downtime, go do whatever you want. Like there's still that freedom, but we're setting bounds on the story a little bit, even as we're still playing to find out.
Yeah, definitely.
I also want to just say, like, there's absolutely, I'm not shitting on open world games either.
Oh, I
like
am.
Sandbox games, yeah, that kind of play is awesome. I love it still. But there's something that you gain, as you were saying earlier, like from restrictions. There's something to be gained from putting bounds on this particular story.
Yeah.
So going back to the like very basic text of the move, there's corollary to the fact that you always succeed on this move, that it would be really bad and break the entire game if a failure on this kind of move meant that the story beat didn't happen. Like, if you have one of these games set up where you're designing a game, like, kind of along the lines that we're talking about, and it's really important that, like, the players do defeat the shadow, or, like, whatever the thing is that we're doing, you can always just make it so that that happens. Like, this move is very smart in that even on a miss, you do make some kind of change because it is important for the game and for your story to get that little bit of success. And then how well you roll is about the scale of the consequences that you end up having to deal with.
That said, I could definitely envision a version of this move where you can not accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that could really hone in, which I don't think the watch particularly is interested in exploring this, but there's a point to be made about stories about war that portray war as something that is quite pointless and just a really shitty time for everyone involved. And the only thing that they create is more war. I can see a version of this move where it's like, well, you didn't accomplish anything or you just made it worse. But if that was there, that would be still creating fiction, and it would be a very deliberate choice instead of it being, oh, let's add a miss condition because all moves have miss conditions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's even a game to be made about war where you never win. Yeah. Like, where the point is that you never defeat your enemy because, like, war fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Like, that's the story that we're telling in that game. To quote Ash, the designer of this game, from a different design, like, that would be a very interesting game, but that is not this game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I love that sentence because I think, as a designer, it is really, really helpful to know exactly what you want your game to be and knowing what fits into that and what doesn't. Even if the, like, doesn't fit in thing is really interesting, knowing that it doesn't belong in your game is a really tough thing to realize sometimes and a really valuable thing to figure out.
Definitely. Because as you're making a game, you get flooded by all of these interesting possibilities. And sometimes it's worth to chase some of them, but there's a very real risk of diluting what you're making just because you went on a bit too many tangents. So you end up not having as strong of a delivery on the core. I would also add to that that you don't owe anyone a specific format so long as it's structurally consistent. You don't need to make every move work in the same fashion. You could even, like, this move could have no rolling. And,
yeah.
it will still work perfectly. And it will totally. Still be a move. Like, because you should always put the themes and the experience that you want to deliver at the table before any sort of convention that you feel you need to stick by.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point.
But don't do it like Blades, where like every single procedure is different. Don't do that. That's bad.
God, right now one of my groups and I are doing this campaign where we were like, we love Blades,
yeah.
We don't want to keep playing in Duskfall. We've done that too much. Mm-hmm. But we're not excited about any other particular like Fortune the Dark game right now.
Yeah.
So we're going to just like pick a setting and go do that and like hack together rules on the fly, using Blades as a baseline. And we're doing just like a Pirates game where like, yeah, you like have some traits and you roll some dice sometimes and I get shit or whatever. And like, I got to get someone from that group to like come on and talk about like the mechanic we threw together on the fly to like like solve the problem at the table. Because that kind of like freeform thing is really interesting
so
to me
good.
Too.
It's also very funny that we made the same game around the same time.
Yeah.
Because I made Curse and BX and then you looked at Curse and BX and you told me, oh yeah, this is what we did.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's cool how those things are cool how
games are
I like,
cool.
Games are cool. I like it when parallel evolution. That's what I'm looking for.
Ooh,
you know,
that
when evolution's like, you know, the meme like evolution's just like another crab. like the crabs just like keep evolving like from like different paths. Like I love when different people end up at the same spot because it for different reasons. Yes. Anyway. So we've talked a lot about like the narrowness of Change the World and like the strengths of that. But I also want to talk about the scale, which we touched on a little bit. But this is a move that is happening like, you know, you're only rolling it twice and it's happening at this like big cultural scale that like you as an individual.
Completely detached from your characters. Your characters are not in this move. They are not going and doing the thing. This just happens as a consequence of the watch as a body rather than as your individual little guy.
Yeah. I think that is one of the coolest parts of this.
Yeah.
That you can, like, just the freedom to think that you can design a mechanic that's operating on that scale of storytelling instead of down at your player level. Like, that's so cool and so smart. Yeah. Like, we're just going to go do a little bit of microscope. That's not like... It's mechanically not at all like microscope, but like at that kind of scale, you can do that. Like it makes sense for the story. It feels right. You're almost like playing with time too in an interesting way because you're just making one die roll, but then you're sort of like dealing with the consequences of your entire like months or years long campaign, and the consequences are going to echo out for generations. And that's so great.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. That's really cool that you can do that.
Noises.
Yeah.
I think it's also really empowering for the players to feel like they can, for a second, just take the reins of the story and say, oh, this thing I'm still thinking about from 5 sessions ago, that was really important. And I want that aspect, that cultural heirloom that I got from one place and I took to another. I want that to become a tradition in this other place. And it's a way of connecting what you individually, because every player rolls his move, by the way. Every player gets to decide what is something that is positively impacted. And it's really rewarding for the player to be able to take those individual standout moments, those individual highlights, and say, and now this is a part of the world of this game. Like now this thing that was just a me thing, we all get to enjoy in our collective understanding of this world.
This is, I'm getting chills again.
I cried. I cried the first time we did this. I literally cried in the session.
I know we said this earlier, but I just want to say it again, that after such a long campaign of misery, like having this moment of, oh, it actually was for something, like we did manage to get some change. It really is just, it's a really powerful moment of opening up and looking at that greater scale.
It's literally psychological aftercare.
Like,
the game does this very intense scene on you where it's just beating you down, but then you get to like cozy up in the sofa for a little bit.
Yeah. The other thing that this does, sort of going off of that on more of a technical scale, is it provides a really great framework for wrapping up the campaign. Mm-hmm. Because the first time you make this move, it is sort of right as you are about to go take the fight to the shadow and like defeat the shadow.
Yeah, so to be clear here, just to provide some context,
yeah.
The game is divided into three main campaign phases. So during the first phase, you are defending what little clans remain untouched by the shadow. You are stopping the shadow's advance. During the second phase, you are reclaiming some of the clan's lost territory, and then you get to trigger this move as you move into the third phase, where you go to assail the Shadowlands. So you go into the stronghold of the shadow to strike it down.
Yeah. And then the last time you make the move is after you have struck down the shadow and you're like wrapping up.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this big emotional release of like, oh my God, we actually have been doing something like at the beginning of that third phase as you go in. But at the end, like this is a really great framework for essentially like a closing montage for a campaign.
It's like the camera zooming out, essentially.
Exactly. You're going to that like closing montage at the end of a season of The Wire, or you're doing the like end of the movie and we're gonna just like pan across everyone that we've seen so far, like over the course of the whole movie and like where they ended up. Or even the end of Star Wars Return of the Jedi, where like seeing everyone partying after the Emperor has been killed. Having some sort of structure for that process, I think, is super helpful and super smart, and a tool that not enough campaign games include. I think ending campaigns is really hard to do, and more games should think really carefully about how they do so. And also, everyone should pick up Everest Pipkin's World Ending Game, which is a whole game about doing this.
I am very intrigued by all those games that have been coming up lately that are just like, this is just a little plugin for whatever you are playing.
Yeah.
I think there's one. I think I once saw one where it was like, this is a game for if all of you died and now you are ghosts and you can play this game if you want to. Like something like that, you know? Like just like these very specific use cases. I think also like the watch, because of all this railroading, right? I think when you play through a campaign of the watch, either as a player or as a facilitator, you end up more skilled at role-playing because you had all these tools explained to you and like really clearly telegraphed, and now you can go on and employ them without these guides.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like a feature that a lot of story games implicitly have. Like if you play a lot of Blades, eventually you're going to be able to just do position and effect in your head. You don't really need position and effect after you've done it 1,000 times.
Yeah.
But you need the mechanic in order to get there in the first place.
Yeah. Or the mechanic is certainly helpful for getting there in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I have a lot of friends who've taken the idea of Devil's Bargains and brought them to PBTA games just because they like the mechanic of Devil's Bargains. Like let's find more consequences for us, which a previous episode I talked with Michael a lot about how getting into trouble is fun and for a story and like makes the story move forward better. And games that teach you how to do that, as you're saying, are great.
Yeah, because, well, I'm going to get a little hashtag deep here, but games like are an oral tradition, really, because you are doing shared storytelling and you are coming up with these techniques that you develop in your journey through whatever you want to call it, like an art form, performance, psychological tool, way of life. So really the texts are just guidelines that you can use to enforce that like oral core. So in a way they are things that like are very, very, very useful to have written down, but on like a scene context of like me and the people that I play with and that I will maybe continue to play with for the years to come. They kind of just get absorbed into how you approach role playing in general. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking about my two long running weekly games and how both have like a very particular table culture that has kind of evolved with and alongside the games that we've played, but also means that in both cases now, I know really, like, we're going to make whatever system we bring in, like, more about our table culture than whatever the system is.
Yeah.
But only by using all of these systems with pretty rigid structures that we were playing around in were we able to find that.
For sure.
Which I think is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, yes. That's part of what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right, well, on that note, Em, thanks so much for being here.
Definitely.
Thank you to Em for joining me. You can find Emma's games at emma-acosta at itch.io and on Patreon at patreon.com/spookymeal. As for myself, you can find me at sdunewald on Twitter, dice.camp, and itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporogory, and our theme song is by Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. Dice Exploder is a production of the Fiction First Network, an actual play and podcast production co-op based out of the Blades in the Dark Discord. Come on by and join us. We would love to see you there. And thanks, as always, to you for listening. See you next time.